You're not in Switzerland. You're standing in the middle of the Ponte Vecchio in Florence.
How do you know that?
Because I'm standing behind you. Janssen wheeled round, the phone to his ear.
I don't see you.
Donati turned as well, slowly.
Excellency? Is that you?
Yes, Nicholas.
Who's the man standing next to you?
A friend.
He's been following me.
He was acting on my behalf.
I was afraid he was going to kill me.
Why would anyone want to kill you?
Forgive me, Excellency,
he whispered.
For what? Grant me absolution.
I have to hear your confession first. He looked to his left.
There isn't time, Excellency.
Janssen lowered the phone and started horizontally across the bridge. In the center of the span, he stopped abruptly and spread his arms wide. The first shot struck him in the left shoulder, spinning him like a top. The second punched a hole through his chest and dropped him penitentially to his knees. There, with his arms now hanging limply at his sides, he received a third shot. It struck him above the right eye and sheared away a large portion of his skull. On the ancient bridge, the shots sounded like cannon fire. Instantly, a maelstrom of panic erupted. Gabriel spotted the assassin briefly as he fled the bridge to the south. Then, turning, he saw Chiara and Donati kneeling over Niklaus Janssen. The final shot had driven him backward, with his legs trapped beneath him. Despite the terrible wound to his head, he was still alive, still conscious. Gabriel crouched over him. He was whispering something. His phone was lying on the paving stones, its screen shattered. Gabriel slipped the device into his coat pocket along with the nylon billfold he plucked from the back pocket of Janssen's jeans. Donati was praying softly, the thumb of his right hand resting near the entrance wound in Janssen's forehead. With two small movements, one vertical, the other horizontal, he absolved the Swiss guard of his sins. By then, an anguished crowd had gathered around them. Gabriel heard expressions of shock and horror in a dozen different languages and, in the distance, the scream of approaching sirens. Rising, he pulled Chiara to her feet, then Donati. As they stepped away from the body, the crowd surged forward. Calmly, they walked north, into the flashing blue light of the 1st Polizia di Stato unit.
What just happened? Asked Donati.
I'm not sure, said Gabriel, but we'll know in a minute. At the foot of the Ponte Vecchio, they joined the exodus of frightened tourists fleeing through the archways of the Vasari corridor. When they reached the entrance of the Uffizi Gallery, Gabriel dug Janssen's phone from his pocket. It was an iPhone, unlocked, 84% charged. His darkest fears, his deepest desires, his very soul, all at Gabriel's fingertips.
Let's hope I was the only one who saw you take it, said Donati reproachfully. And his wallet.
You were, but try not to look so guilty.
I just fled the scene of a murder. What on earth do I have to feel guilty about?
Gabriel pressed the home button. Several applications were opened, including a stream of text messages. He scrolled to the top of the exchange. There was no name, only a number. Written in English, the first text had arrived at 4:47 p.m. the previous afternoon. Please tell me where you are, Nicholas.
We've got him.
Who?
Asked Donati, the person who was sending text messages to Janssen while we were following him. Donati peered over Gabriel's right shoulder, Chiara over his left, their faces lit by the glow of the iPhone. All at once, the light was extinguished. Gabriel pressed the home button again, but there was no response. The phone had not drifted off to sleep, it had shut down entirely. Gabriel squeezed the power button and waited for the ubiquitous white apple to appear on the screen. Nothing. The phone was as dead as its owner.
Perhaps you touched something by mistake, suggested Donati.
Are you referring to the magic icon that instantly blows up the operating system and shreds the memory? Gabriel looked up from the darkened screen. It was erased remotely so we couldn't see what was on it.
By whom?
The same men who deleted his personnel file from the Swiss Guard computer network. Gabriel looked at Chiara. The same men who murdered the Holy Father.
Do you believe me now? Asked Donati.
10 minutes ago I had my doubts. Not anymore. Gabriel stared at the Ponte Vecchio. It was ablaze with flashing blue lights. Were you able to make out what he was whispering before he died?
He was speaking in Aramaic. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. It means,
my God, why have you forsaken me? Donati nodded slowly. They were the last words Jesus cried out before dying on the cross. Why would he say such a thing?
Maybe the other guards were right, said Donati.
Maybe Niklaus was a saint after all. Chapter 15. Venice, Fribourg, Switzerland. They returned to Venice, collected two sleeping children from a house in the ancient ghetto, and carried them across the city's only iron bridge to an apartment on the Rio della Misericordia. There, they passed a largely sleepless night, Donati in the spare room. At breakfast, the following morning, he could scarcely take his eyes off Raphael, who bore a striking resemblance to his famous father. The child had even been cursed with Gabriel's unnaturally green eyes. Irene looked like Gabriel's mother, never more so than when she was annoyed with him. "It will only be a day or two," he assured her.
"That's what you always say, Abba."
They said their goodbyes downstairs on the Fondamenta dei Ormesini. Chiara's final kiss was decorous.
"Do try not to get yourself killed," she whispered into Gabriel's ear. "Your children need you, and so do I."
Gabriel and Donati settled into the aft seating compartment of a waiting motoscafo and skimmed across the gray-green waters of the lagoon to Marco Polo Airport. In the crowded concourse, passengers were gathered beneath the television monitors. Another bomb had exploded in Germany. This time the target was a market in the northern city of Hamburg. A claim of responsibility had appeared on social media, along with a professionally edited video from the purported mastermind. In perfect colloquial German, his face concealed behind an Arab headdress, he promised the bombings would continue until the black flag of the Islamic State flew over the Bundestag. Having suffered two terrorist attacks in just 48 hours, Germany was now on high alert. The bombing immediately snarled air travel across Europe, but somehow the late morning Alitalia flight to Geneva departed on time. Despite the increased security at Switzerland's second busiest airport, Gabriel and Donati cleared passport control with no delay. Transport had left a BMW sedan in the short-term car park, with the key taped beneath the front bumper. In the glove box, wrapped in a protective cloth, was a 9mm Beretta.
"It must be nice," remarked Donati. "I always have to pick up my gun at the counter."
"Membership has its privileges." Gabriel followed the airport exit ramp to the E-62 and headed northwest along the shore of the lake. Donati took note of the fact he was driving without the aid of a navigation device.
"Come to Switzerland often?"
"You might say that. They say it's going to be another bad year for snow. The state of Switzerland's winter tourism industry is the least of my concerns."
"You don't ski?"
"Do I look like a skier to you?"
"I never saw the point of it."
Donati pondered the mountain peaks rising above the opposite shore of the lake.
"Any fool can slide down a mountain, but it takes someone of character and discipline to walk up one."
"I prefer to walk along the sea."
"It's rising, you know. Apparently Venice will soon be uninhabitable."
"At least it will discourage the tourists." Gabriel switched on the radio in time to catch the hourly newscast on SFR1. The death toll in Hamburg stood at 4, with another 25 wounded, several critically. There was no mention of a Swiss citizen having been murdered the previous evening on the Ponte Vecchio in Florence.
"What are the Polizia di Stato waiting for?" asked Donati.
"If I had to guess, they're giving the Vatican a chance to get its story straight."
"Good luck with that."
The last item on the newscast concerned a report by the Episcopal Conference of Switzerland detailing a sharp increase in the number of new sexual abuse cases. Donati sighed.
"I wish they would talk about something uplifting. The bombing in Hamburg, for example."
"Did you know the report was coming?"
Donati nodded. "The Holy Father and I reviewed the first draft a few weeks before his death."
"How is it possible there are still new cases of abuse?"
"Because we apologized and asked for forgiveness, but we never addressed the root causes of the problem. And the Church has deservedly paid a terrible price. Here in Switzerland, Roman Catholicism is on life support. Baptisms, church weddings, and mass attendance have all fallen to extinction levels."
"And if you had it to do over again?"
"Despite what my enemies used to say about me, I was not the Pope. Pietro Lucchese was. And he was an innately cautious man."
Donati paused.
"Too cautious, in my opinion."
"And if you were the one with the ring of the fisherman on his finger?"
Donati laughed.
"What's so funny?"
"The very idea is preposterous."
"Humor me."
Donati considered his answer carefully. I'd start by reforming the priesthood. It's not enough merely to weed out the pedophiles. We must create a new and dynamic global community of Catholic religious if the Church is to survive and flourish. Does that mean you would admit women into the priesthood?
You said it, not me.
How about married priests? Now we're sailing into treacherous waters, my friend. Other faiths allow their clergy to marry, and I respect those faiths. The question is, can I, as a Roman Catholic priest, love and cherish a wife and children, while at the same time serving the Lord and tending to the spiritual needs of my flock? What's the answer?
No,
said Donati. I cannot. A sign warned they were approaching the lakeside resort town of Veve. Gabriel turned onto the E27 and followed it north to Fribourg. It was a bilingual city, but the streets bore French names. The Rue du Pont Moret stretched for about 100 meters through the elegant old town, above which soared the spire of the cathedral. Gabriel parked the car in the Place des Ormeaux and took a table at Café des Arcades. Alone, Donati crossed the street to Café du Gothard. It was a formal, old-fashioned restaurant with a dark wooden floor and heavy iron fixtures overhead. At that hour, the twilight between lunch and dinner, only one other table was occupied by an English couple who looked as though they had just declared a fragile truce after a long and calamitous battle. The maitre d' showed Donati to a table near the window. He dialed Gabriel's number and then laid his Nokia face down on the tabletop. Several minutes elapsed before Stephanie Hoffmann appeared. She placed a menu before him and with considerable effort smiled.
Something to drink?
Chapter 16. Café du Gothard, Fribourg. She tucked a loose strand of blonde hair behind her ear and peered at Donati over the top of an order pad. Her eyes were the color of an alpine lake in summer. The rest of her face matched their beauty. The cheekbones were broad, the jawline was sharp, the chin was narrow with a slight indentation. She had addressed Donati in French. He responded in the same language. A glass of wine, please. With the tip of her pen, she pointed toward the section of the menu devoted to the café's selection of wines. They were mainly French and Swiss. Donati chose a Chasselas.
Something to eat? Just the wine for now, thank you.
She walked over to the bar and checked her phone while a black-shirted colleague poured the wine. The glass sat atop her tray for a moment or two before she finally delivered it to Donati's table.
You're not from Fribourg, she observed.
How could you possibly tell?
Italy?
Rome. Her expression was unchanged.
What brings you to dull Fribourg?
Business.
What business are you in?
Donati hesitated. He had never found a satisfactory way to admit what he did for his living.
I suppose I'm in the business of salvation.
Her eyes narrowed.
You're a clergyman?
A priest, said Donati.
You don't look much like a priest.
Her eyes flashed over him provocatively.
Especially in those clothes.
He wondered whether she addressed all her customers in so forward a manner.
Actually, I'm an archbishop. Where's your archdiocese?
She was obviously familiar with the lexicon of Catholicism. A remote corner of North Africa that was once part of the Roman Empire. There are very few Christians there any longer, let alone Catholics.
A titular see?
Exactly.
What do you really do?
I'm about to begin teaching at the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome.
You're a Jesuit?
I'm afraid so.
And before the Gregoriana?
Donati lowered his voice. I served as the private secretary to His Holiness Pope Paul VII. A shadow seemed to fall across her face.
What are you doing in Fribourg? She asked again.
I came to see you.
Why?
I need to talk to you about Nikolaus.
Where is he?
You don't know?
No.
When was the last time you heard from him?
It was the morning of the Pope's funeral. He wouldn't tell me where he was.
Why not?
He said he didn't want them to know.
Who? She started to answer, but stopped.
Have you seen him?
She asked.
Yes, Stephanie. I'm afraid I have.
When?
Last night, said Donati. On the Ponte Vecchio, in Florence. From his observation post at Café des Arcades, Gabriel listened as Donati quietly told Stefanie Hoffmann that Niklaus Jansson was dead. He was glad it was his old friend on the other side of the street and not him. If Donati always labored over how to acknowledge his occupation, Gabriel likewise struggled over how to tell a woman that a loved one, a son, a brother, a father, a fiancé, had been murdered in cold blood. She didn't believe Donati at first, which was to be expected. His response, that he had no motive to lie about such a thing, did little to dilute her skepticism. The Vatican, she shot back, lied all the time. I don't work for the Vatican, answered Donati. Not anymore. He then suggested they speak somewhere private. Stefanie Hoffmann said the restaurant closed at 10 and that her boss would kill her if she left him in the lurch. Your boss will understand. What do I say to him about Niklaus? Absolutely nothing. My car is in the Place des Ormeaux. Wait for me there. Donati went into the street and lifted the phone to his ear. Were you able to hear all that? She knows, answered Gabriel. The question is, how much? Donati slipped the phone into his pocket without killing the connection. Stefanie Hoffmann emerged from the restaurant a few minutes later, a scarf around her neck. Her car was a worn-out Volvo. Donati lowered himself into the passenger seat as Gabriel slid behind the wheel of the BMW. Through his earpiece he heard the click of Donati's safety belt, followed, an instant later, by a wail of anguish from Stefanie Hoffmann.
Is Niklaus really dead?
I saw it happen.
Why didn't you stop it?
There was nothing to be done. Stefanie Hoffmann reversed out of the parking space and turned onto the Rue du Pont Moret. 10 seconds later, Gabriel did the same. As they left the old town on the Route des Alpes, Donati asked why Niklaus Jansson had fled the Vatican the night of the Holy Father's death. Her response was scarcely audible.
He was afraid.
Afraid of what?
That they were going to kill him.
Who, Stefanie? For a long moment there was only the rattle of the Volvo's engine, followed a moment later by the sound of Stefanie Hoffmann screaming. Gabriel lowered the volume on his phone. He was glad it was his old friend sitting next to her, and not him. Chapter 17. Rechthalten, Switzerland. As they approached the hamlet of St. Olsen, Stefanie Hoffmann became aware of the fact they were being followed. It's only an associate of mine, explained Donati.
Since when do priests have associates?
He's the man who helped me find Niklaus in Florence.
I thought you said you came to Fribourg alone.
I said no such thing.
Is this associate of yours a priest too?
No.
Vatican intelligence?
Donati was tempted to inform Stefanie Hoffmann that there was no department of the Holy See known as Vatican intelligence, that it was a canard invented by Catholicism's enemies, that the real intelligence-gathering apparatus of the Vatican was the Universal Church itself, with its global network of parishes, schools, universities, hospitals, charitable organizations, and nuncios in capitals around the world. He spared her this discourse, at least for the moment. Still, he was curious why she would ask such a question. It could wait, he decided, until his associate had joined them. The next village was Rechthalten. Donati recognized the name. It was the village where Niklaus Jansson had been born and raised. Its inhabitants were overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. Most were employed in what government statisticians referred to as the primary sector of the economy, a polite way of saying they worked the land. A handful, like Stefanie Hoffmann, commuted each day to Fribourg. She had moved out of the family home about a year ago, she said, and was living alone in a cottage at the far eastern edge of the town. It was shaped like an A, with a small sun deck on the upper floor. She turned into the unpaved drive and switched off the engine. Gabriel arrived a few seconds later. In German, he introduced himself as Heinrich Kiewer. It was a name on the false German passport he had displayed earlier that afternoon at Geneva Airport.
Are you sure you're not a priest?
Stefanie Hoffmann accepted his outstretched hand.
You look more like a priest than the Archbishop.
She led them inside the cottage. The ground floor had been converted into an artist's studio.
Stephanie Hoffman, though not he remembered suddenly, was a painter. Her latest work was propped on an easel in the center of the room. The man she knew as Heinrich Kiefer stood before it, a hand to his chin, his head tilted slightly to one side.
"This is quite good."
"Do you paint?"
"Only the occasional watercolor while on holiday." Stephanie Hoffman was clearly dubious. She removed her coat and scarf and looked at Donati as tears fell from her blue eyes.
"Something to drink?"
Her breakfast dishes were still on the table in her tiny kitchen. She cleared them away and filled the electric kettle with bottled water. As she spooned coffee into the French press, she apologized for the chaotic state of the cottage and for its modesty. It was all she could afford, she lamented, on her salary from the restaurant and the small amount of money she earned through the sale of her paintings. "We're not all rich private bankers, you know." She addressed them in German, not the dialect of Swiss German spoken in the village, but proper High German, the language of her Alemannic brethren to the north. She had learned to speak it in school, she explained, beginning at the age of 6. Niklaus Jansson had been a classmate. He was an awkward boy, skinny, shy, bespectacled, but at 17 he was somehow magically transformed into an object of striking beauty. The first time they made love, he insisted on removing his crucifix. Afterward, he confessed to Father Erich, the village priest. "He was a very religious boy, Niklaus. It was one of the things I liked about him. He said he never mentioned my name in the confessional, but Father Erich gave me quite a look when I took communion the next Sunday." After completing their secondary education at the local Kantonschule, Stephanie studied art at the University of Fribourg, and Niklaus, whose father was a carpenter, enlisted in the Swiss Army. At the conclusion of his service, he returned to Rechthalten and started looking for work. It was Father Erich who suggested he join the Swiss Guard, which was undermanned at the time and desperately looking for recruits. Stephanie Hoffman was vehemently opposed to the idea.
"Why?" asked Donati.
"I was afraid I was going to lose him."
"To what?"
"The church."
"You thought he might become a priest?"
"He talked about it all the time, even after he got out of the military."
He was subjected to no background check or formal interview. Father Erich's affirmation that Niklaus was a practicing Catholic of good moral character was all it took. On the night before he left for Rome, he gave Stephanie an engagement ring with a small diamond. She was wearing it a few months later when she attended the solemn ceremony held in the San Damaso courtyard, where Niklaus swore to lay down his life to defend the Vatican and the Holy Father. He was exceedingly proud of his dress uniform and red-plumed medieval-style helmet. But Stephanie thought he looked rather silly, a toy soldier in the world's smallest army. After the ceremony, he took his parents to meet His Holiness. Stephanie was not allowed to come. Only wives and mothers could meet the Holy Father. The God doesn't like girlfriends. She saw Niklaus every couple of months, but they did their best to keep up their relationship with daily video calls and text messages. The work of the Swiss Guard was grueling and, most of the time, terribly dull. Niklaus used to recite the rosary while standing his 3-hour shifts, his feet pointing outward at 60-degree angles, as per Swiss Guard regulations. He spent most of his free time in the Swiss Quarter, the Guard's enclave near St. Anne's Gate. Like most Swiss, he thought Rome was a filthy mess. Within a year of joining the Guard, he was working inside the Apostolic Palace. There he observed the comings and goings of the most senior princes of the Church: Gobert, the Secretary of State; Albanese, keeper of the secret archives; Navarro, keeper of the faith itself. But the Vatican official Niklaus admired most did not wear a red hat. He was the Holy Father's private secretary, Archbishop Luigi Donati.
"He used to say that if the Church had any sense, it would make you the next pope."
She managed a smile, which faded as she described Niklaus's downward spiral into depression and drinking. Somehow, Donati had missed the signs of Niklaus's emotional turmoil. One priest, however, had noticed, a priest who worked in a relatively insignificant department of the Roman Curia, something to do with establishing a dialogue between the Church and non-believers. "Could it have been the Pontifical Council for Culture?" probed Donati gently.
"Yes, that's it."
"And
The priest's name?
Father Marcus Graf.
Donati gave his associate a look that made it clear the priest in question was pure trouble. Stephanie Hoffman, while pouring boiling water into the French press, explained why.
He's a member of a reactionary order, secretive too.
The Order of St. Helena, said Donati, more for Gabriel's benefit than Stephanie Hoffman's.
Do you know him?
Donati revealed a flash of his old arrogance. Father Graf and I move in rather different circles. I met him once. He's slippery as an eel, but quite charismatic, seductive even. Niklaus was quite taken with him. The guard has its own chaplain, but Niklaus chose Father Graf as his confessor and spiritual guide. They also began spending a great deal of time together, socially.
Socially?
Father Graf had a car. He used to take Niklaus to the mountains around Rome so he wouldn't be homesick. The Apennines aren't exactly the Alps, but Niklaus enjoyed getting out of the city. He was reprimanded twice for curfew violations. I'm sure it had something to do with Father Graf.
Was there anything more to their relationship?
Are you asking whether Niklaus and Father Graf were lovers?
I suppose I am.
The thought crossed my mind, especially after the way he acted the last time I went to Rome.
What happened?
He refused to have sex with me.
Did he give you a reason?
Father Graf had instructed him not to engage in sexual intercourse outside of marriage.
And how did you react?
I said we should get married right away. Niklaus agreed, but on one condition.
He said you had to become a lay member of the Order of St. Helena.
Yes.
I assume Niklaus was already a member?
He swore his oath of obedience to Bishop Richter at the Order's palazzo on the Janiculum Hill. He said Bishop Richter had reservations about certain aspects of my character, but had agreed to allow me to join.
How did Bishop Richter know about you?
Father Erich. He's a member of the Order, too.
What did you do?
I threw my engagement ring into the Tiber and returned to Switzerland.
Do you recall the date?
How could I forget? It was the 9th of October.
She poured 3 cups of coffee and placed one before the man she knew as Heinrich Kiefer.
Doesn't he have any questions for me?
Herr Kiefer is a man of few words.
Just like Niklaus.
She sat down at the table. After I refused to join the order, he cut off all communication. Tuesday was the first time I'd spoken to him in weeks.
And you're sure it was the morning of the Holy Father's funeral?
She nodded.
He sounded awful. For a moment, I didn't think it was him. When I asked what was wrong, he just cried.
What did you do then?
I asked him again.
And?
She raised her coffee to her lips.
He told me everything.
Chapter 18. Brechthalten, Switzerland. Niklaus had already pulled 2 shifts that day. Arch of bells in the morning, bronze doors in the afternoon. When he arrived at the papal apartments at 9 p.m., his legs were shaking with fatigue. The first person he saw was the Holy Father's private secretary. He was on his way out.
Did he know where I was going?
Dinner with a friend outside the walls.
Did he know the friend's name?
A rich woman who lived near the Villa Borghese. Her husband died in a fall from the dome of the basilica. Niklaus said, you were there when it happened.
Where did he hear a thing like that?
Where do you think?
Father Graf?
She nodded. She was holding her mug of coffee with both hands. A nimbus of steam swirled about her flawless face.
What happened after I left?
Cardinal Albanese arrived around 9:30.
The cardinal told me he didn't arrive until 10.
That was his second visit, said Stephanie Hoffman, not the first.
Cardinal Albanese had not told Donati about an earlier visit to the Appartamento, nor had he included it in the official Vatican timeline.
That single inconsistency, were it ever to become public, would be enough to plunge the church into scandal.
Did Albanese tell Niklaus why he was there?
No, but he was carrying an attaché case with the coat of arms of the archives on the side.
How long did he stay?
Only a few minutes.
Did he have the attaché case when he left?
She nodded.
And when he came back at 10 o'clock?
He told Niklaus that the Holy Father had invited him to pray in the private chapel.
Who arrived next?
3 cardinals, Navarro, Gobert, and Francona.
The time?
10:15.
When did Dottore Gallo arrive?
11 o'clock.
Colonel Metzler and a Vatican cop showed up a few minutes after that.
She lowered her voice.
Then you, Archbishop Donati, you were the last.
Did Niklaus know what was happening inside?
He had a pretty good idea, but he wasn't certain until the ambulance attendants arrived with the gurney.
A few minutes after they entered the apartment, she continued, Metzler came out. He confirmed the obvious. The Holy Father was dead. He warned Niklaus that he was never to speak of what he had witnessed that evening. Not to his comrades in the guard, not to his friends and family, and certainly not to the media. Then he ordered Niklaus to remain on duty until the Holy Father's body was removed and the apartment sealed. The Camerlengo performed the ritual at 2:30.
Did Cardinal Albanese remove anything from the apartment when he left?
One item. He said he wanted something to help him remember the saintliness of the Holy Father. Something he had touched.
What was it?
A book.
Donati's heart banged against his ribcage.
What kind of book?
An English murder mystery.
Stephanie Hoffman shook her head.
Can you imagine that?
By the time Niklaus left the Apostolic Palace, the press office had announced the Holy Father's death. St. Peter's Square was ablaze with the spectral light of the television crews, and in the cloisters and courtyards of the Vatican, nuns and priests were gathered in small groups, praying, weeping. Niklaus was weeping too. Alone in his room in the barracks, he changed into civilian clothing and tossed a few things into his duffel bag. He slipped out of the Vatican around 5:30 that morning.
Why did he go to Florence instead of coming home to Switzerland?
He was afraid they would find him.
The guard?
The order.
And you had no other contact other than the single phone call? No texts or emails?
Only the package. It arrived the day after I spoke to him.
What was it?
A dreadful devotional painting of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. I can't imagine why he would send me such a thing.
Was there anything else in the package?
Niklaus's rosary. She paused, then added, and a letter.
A letter?
She nodded.
To whom was it addressed?
Me, who else?
What did it say?
He apologized for joining the Order of St. Helena and breaking off our engagement. He said it was a terrible mistake. He said they were evil, especially Bishop Richter.
May I read it?
No, she said. Some parts are too private.
Donati let it go, for now.
Colonel Metzler told me he spoke to you.
He called me the day after the Holy Father died.
He said Niklaus had left the barracks without authorization. He asked whether I'd spoken to him.
I told him I hadn't, which was true at the time.
Was Metzler the only person who contacted you?
No.
I heard from someone else the next day.
Who?
Herr Bauer, the man from Vatican Intelligence.
There it was again, thought Donati. Vatican Intelligence.
Did Herr Bauer show you any identification?
She shook her head.
Did he say what division of Vatican Intelligence he worked for?
Papal Security.
First name?
Maximilian.
Swiss?
German.
Probably from Bavaria, judging by the accent.
He phoned you?
No, he showed up at the restaurant unannounced, like you and Herr Kiefer.
What did he want?
The same thing Metzler wanted.
Where was Niklaus?
And when you told him you didn't know?
I'm not sure he believed me.
Describe him, please.
It was Gabriel who had posed the question. Stephanie Hoffman lifted her eyes to the ceiling.
Tall, well-dressed, late 40s, maybe early 50s.
With his expression, Gabriel made it clear her answer was a disappointment.
Come now, Stephanie, you can do better than that. You're an artist, after all.
I'm a contemporary painter who reveres Rothko and Pollock. Portraits aren't my specialty.
But surely you could produce one in a pinch.
Not a good one, and not from memory.
Perhaps I can be of help.
How?
Bring me your sketch pad and a box of acrylic pencils and I'll show you. They worked without pause for the better part of the next hour, side by side at the kitchen table, with Donate watching anxiously over their shoulders. As Gabriel suspected, Stephanie Hoffmann's memory of the man she knew as Maximilian Bauer was far sharper than even she had imagined. All it took were the right sort of questions posed by an expert draftsman and student of human anatomy, a gifted restorer who could mimic the brushstrokes of Bellini and Titian and Tintoretto, a healer who had repaired the tattered face of Mary and the pierced hand of Christ. It was a noble face, she described. High cheekbones, a slender nose, a refined chin, a thin mouth that did not smile easily, all crowned by a shock of gray-blonde hair. He was a worthy opponent, thought Gabriel, a man not to be trifled with, a man who never lost at games of chance. So much for the occasional watercolor on holiday, said Stephanie Hoffmann. You're obviously a professional. But I'm afraid the eyes are all wrong. I drew the eyes the way you described them. Not quite. She took the pad and on a blank page sketched a pair of humorless eyes set deeply beneath the ledge of a prominent brow. Gabriel then sketched the rest of the face around them. That's him. That's the man who came to see me. Gabriel looked over his shoulder at Donati. Do you recognize him? I'm afraid not. Stephanie Hoffmann took the sketch from Gabriel and deepened the lines around the mouth. Now it's perfect, she said. But what are you going to do with it? I'm going to find out who he really is. She looked up from the sketch pad. But who are you? I'm an associate of the Archbishop. Are you a priest? No, said Gabriel. I'm a professional. Which left only the letter. The letter in which Niklaus Janson had described the Order of St. Helena as evil. Three times Donati asked to see it. Three times Stephanie Hoffmann refused. The letter was of an intensely personal nature, written by an emotionally distressed man whom she had known since childhood, a man who had been publicly murdered on the most famous bridge in Italy. She would not show such a letter to her closest friend and confidant, she insisted, let alone a Roman Catholic archbishop. In that case, said Donati, might I at least see the picture? Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane? You don't get enough of that sort of thing at the Vatican? I have my reasons. It was propped against the wall behind Stephanie Hoffmann's chair, still entombed in a shallow cardboard box. Donati checked the waybill. It was from a DHS express near Roma Termini. Niklaus must have shipped it before boarding the train to Florence. Donati removed the picture from the box and freed it from its cocoon of bubble wrap. It was about 14 inches by 12. The illustration itself was a rather shop-worn depiction of Jesus on the night before his torture and execution at the hands of the Romans. The frame, museum glass, and matting were of high quality. Bishop Richter gave it to him the day he swore his oath of allegiance to the order, explained Stephanie Hoffmann. If you turn it over, you'll see the order's coat of arms. Donati was still staring at the image of Jesus. Don't tell me you actually like it. It's not exactly Michelangelo, he admitted, but it's nearly identical to a picture that hung in my parents' bedroom, in the little house in Umbria where I was raised. Donati did not tell Stephanie Hoffmann that after his mother's death, he found several thousand euros hidden inside the picture. His mother, justifiably, had distrusted Italian banks. He turned over the picture. The Order of St. Helena's coat of arms was embossed on the back of the matting, which was held in place by four metal brackets. One of the clasps, however, was loose. Donati removed the other three and attempted to pry away the matting. Failing, he turned over the frame and allowed the weight of the glass panel to do the task for him. It landed on the tabletop without shattering. Donati separated the matting from the picture and found a cream-colored envelope, also of high quality. It too was decorated with a coat of arms. The private papal armorial of His Holiness Pope Paul VII. Donati lifted the flap. Inside were three sheets of rich stationery, almost like fine linen. He read the first lines, then
He returned the letter to the envelope and pushed it across the table, toward Gabriel.
"Forgive me," he said. "I believe this belongs to you."
Chapter 19. Les Amours, Geneva. It was approaching 9 o'clock by the time Gabriel and Donati arrived in Geneva, too late to make the last flight to Rome. They checked into adjacent rooms at a small hotel near the Saint-Pierre Cathedral and then walked to Les Amours, a wood-paneled restaurant in the old town. After placing his order, Gabriel rang a friend who worked for the NDB, Switzerland's small but capable Foreign Intelligence and Internal Security Service. The friend, whose name was Christophe Bittel, was the head of the counterterrorism division. He answered guardedly. Gabriel had a long and distinguished track record in Switzerland. Bittel was still cleaning up the mess from his last visit.
"Where are you?" Gabriel answered truthfully.
"I'd order the veal cutlet if I were you."
"I just did."
"How long have you been in the country?"
"A few hours."
"I don't suppose you arrived on a valid passport?"
"Define valid."
Bittel sighed before inquiring as to the reason for Gabriel's call.
"I'd like you to place a Swiss citizen under protective surveillance."
"How unusual! What's the Swiss citizen's name?"
Gabriel told him, then recited her address and place of work.
"Is she an ISIS terrorist? A Russian assassin?"
"No, Bittel. She's a painter."
"Anyone in particular you're worried about?"
"I'll send you a composite. But whatever you do, don't give the job to that kid who watched my back in Bern a couple of years ago."
"He's one of my best men. He's also a former Swiss guard. Does this have something to do with Florence?"
"Why do you ask?"
"The Polizia di Stato just released the name of the victim in that shooting last night. He was a Swiss guard. Come to think of it, he was from Rechthalten too."
Gabriel killed the connection and checked the website of Corriere della Sera, Italy's premier newspaper. Donati went straight to the Twitter feed of the Vatican Press Office. There was a brief bollettino 5 minutes old. It expressed the Holy See's shock and sorrow over the senseless and random act of gun violence that had claimed the life of Lance Corporal Nikolaus Janssen of the Pontifical Swiss Guard. It made no mention of the fact that Janssen was on duty outside the papal apartments the night of the Holy Father's death. Nor did it explain why he was in Florence while his comrades were working overtime in preparation for the conclave.
"It's a masterpiece of curial doublespeak," said Donati. "On its face, the statement is entirely accurate. But the lies of omission are glaring. Clearly, Cardinal Albanese has no intention of allowing Nicholas's murder to delay the opening of the conclave. Perhaps we can convince him to see the error of his ways."
"With what? A tawdry tale of sex and secretive religious orders, told by a woman who was bitter over the dissolution of her engagement to a handsome young Swiss guard?"
"You don't believe her story?"
"I believe every word of it. But that doesn't change the fact that it's pure hearsay, or that every element can be denied."
"Except for this." Gabriel displayed the envelope. The high-quality cream-colored envelope, embossed with the private papal armorial of His Holiness Pope Paul VII. "Do you really expect me to believe you didn't know what was in this letter?"
"I didn't."
Gabriel removed the 3 sheets of stationery from the envelope. The letter had been composed in pale blue ink. The salutation was informal, first name only. "Dear Gabriel." There were no preliminaries or pleasantries. "While researching in the Vatican secret archives, I came upon a most remarkable book." The book, he continued, had been given to him by a member of the archive's staff without the knowledge of the prefetto. It was stored in what was known as the Collezione, a secret archive within the secret archives, located on the lower level of the manuscript depository. The material in the Collezione was highly sensitive. Some of the books and files were political and administrative in nature, others were doctrinal. None were referenced in the 1,000 directories and catalogs housed in the index room. Indeed, nowhere within the archives was there a written inventory of the material. The knowledge was passed down through the centuries, verbally, prefetto to prefetto. The letter did not identify the book in question, only that it had been suppressed by the church
during the Middle Ages, and had circulated secretly until the Renaissance, when it was finally hunted out of existence. The copy contained in the secret archives was thought to be the last. The Holy Father had concluded it was authentic and accurate in its depiction of an important historical event. It was his intention to place the book in Gabriel's hands at the earliest possible date. Gabriel would be free to do with it as he pleased. His Holiness asked only that he treat the material with the utmost sensitivity. The book would ignite a global sensation. Its unveiling would have to be carefully managed. Otherwise, the Holy Father warned, it would be dismissed as a hoax. The letter was unfinished. The final sentence was a fragment, the last word incomplete. Archive. Gabriel reckoned the Holy Father had been interrupted mid-sentence by the appearance of his killer. Donati did not disagree. His prime suspect was Cardinal Camerlengo Domenico Albanese, Prefetto of the Vatican Secret Archives. Gabriel politely informed Donati that he was mistaken. Then why did Albanese lie to me about his earlier visit to the Appartamento? I'm not saying he wasn't involved in the Holy Father's murder, but he wasn't the actual killer. He was only the bagman. Gabriel held up the letter. Can we stipulate that the existence of this letter in Stephanie Hoffmann's home is proof that Niklaus Jansson did not tell her everything that happened that night? So stipulated. Gabriel lowered the letter. When Albanese arrived at 9:30, the Holy Father was already dead. That's when he removed the book from the papal study. He came back to the papal apartments at 10 o'clock and carried the Holy Father's body from the study into the bedroom. But why didn't he remove the letter when he removed the book? Because it wasn't there. It was in Niklaus Jansson's pocket. He removed it before Albanese arrived the first time. Why? If I had to guess, Niklaus was feeling guilty about letting the murderer into the papal apartments. After the killer left, he went inside to investigate. That was when he found the Holy Father dead and an unfinished letter lying on the desk blotter. Why would Niklaus Jansson have let a murderer into the papal apartments? He loved the Holy Father. That's the easy part. The killer was someone he knew, someone he trusted. Gabriel paused. Someone he was sworn to obey. Donati made no reply. Did Veronica tell you that Jansson and Father Graf were involved in a sexual relationship? Donati hesitated and nodded. Why didn't you tell me? Because I didn't think it was true, he paused. Until tonight. Who are they, Luigi? The Order of St. Helena? Yes. They're trouble, said Donati. Pure, unadulterated, undiluted, irredeemable trouble. Chapter 20. Les Amours, Geneva. Then again, Donati added, the Order of St. Helena had been troubled from the beginning. The year of our Lord 1928, the midpoint between the end of the First World War and the beginning of the Second. A time of great social and political upheaval and uncertainty over the future. In the southern German state of Bavaria, an obscure priest named Father Ulrich Schiller came to believe that only Roman Catholicism, in partnership with monarchs and political leaders from the extreme right, could save Europe from the godless Bolsheviks. He established his first seminary in the town of Bergen in Upper Bavaria and quietly recruited a network of like-minded political leaders and businessmen that stretched westward to Spain and Portugal and eastward to the doorstep of the Soviet Union. The lay membership of the order soon dwarfed its priestly caste and was the true source of its power and influence. The names were kept secret. Inside the order, only Father Schiller had access to the directory. It was a leather-bound ledger, said Donati. Quite beautiful, apparently. Father Schiller entered the names himself, along with the secret contact information. Each member was assigned a number and swore an oath, not to the church, but to the order. It was all very political and quasi-military. The order wasn't terribly concerned with doctrine during those early years. They saw themselves first and foremost as holy warriors, prepared to do battle with the enemies of Christ and Roman Catholicism. What was the origin of the name?
Father Schiller made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem in the early 20s. He prayed for hours on end in the Garden of Gethsemane and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's built on the site where Helena, the mother of Constantine, was said to have found the exact spot where Jesus was crucified and buried.
Yes, I know, said Gabriel. I happen to live not far from there.
Forgive me, replied Donatim.
Father Schiller, he continued, was obsessed with the crucifixion. He flogged himself daily, and during the holy season of Lent, he pierced his palms with a nail and slept wearing a crown of thorns. His devotion to the memory of Christ's suffering and death went hand in hand with his hatred of Jews, whom he viewed as the murderers of God.
We're not talking about doctrinal anti-Judaism. Father Schiller was a rabid anti-Semite. Even during the earliest years of the Zionist movement, he was alarmed by the prospect of Jews controlling the sacred Christian sites of Jerusalem.
It was only natural, Donati resumed, that a man such as Father Schiller would find common cause with the Austrian corporal who seized power in Germany in 1933. Father Schiller was not an ordinary member of the Nazi Party. He wore a coveted golden party badge.
In his 1936 book, The Doctrine of National Socialism, he argued that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis offered the surest path to a Christian Europe. Hitler read the book and admired it greatly. He kept a copy at his mountain retreat in the Obersalzberg near Berchtesgaden. During a contentious meeting with the Archbishop of Munich, he cited Father Schiller's book as proof that Catholics and Nazis could work together to defend Germany against the Bolsheviks and the Jews. Hitler once remarked to Father Schiller that when it came to the Jews, he was merely carrying out the same policy the Church had adopted 1,500 years earlier. Father Schiller did not dispute Hitler's interpretation of Catholic history.
Do I have to ask how the order conducted itself during the war?
I'm afraid it remained loyal to Hitler even after it became clear he was determined to murder every last Jew in Europe. Priests from the order traveled with SS Einsatzgruppen units in the Baltics and the Ukraine, and granted the murderers absolution each night when the killing was done. French members of the order sided with Vichy, and in Italy they supported Mussolini to the bitter end. The order also had ties to the clerical fascists in Slovakia and Croatia. The conduct of those two regimes is an indelible stain on the history of the Church.
And when the war was over?
A new war began, a global contest between the West and the godless Soviet Union. Father Schiller and the order were suddenly very much in vogue.
With the tacit approval of Pope Pius XII, Schiller helped dozens of fugitive German and Croatian war criminals escape to South America, which the order regarded as the next battlefield in the war between Christianity and communism. Funded by the Vatican, it established a network of seminaries and schools throughout Latin America and recruited thousands of new lay members, mainly wealthy landowners, soldiers, and secret policemen. During the dirty wars of the 1970s and 1980s, the order once again sided with the murderers rather than the victims. In 1987, the year of Father Schiller's death, the order was at the zenith of its power. It had at least 50,000 lay members, 1,000 ordained priests, and another 1,000 diocesan clergy who were members of something called the Priestly Society of the Order of St. Helena. When Lucchese and I moved into the Apostolic Palace, they were among the most influential forces within the Church.
What did you do?
We clipped their wings.
How did they react?
Exactly as you would expect. Bishop Hans Richter loathed my master, almost as much as he loathes me.
Is Richter German?
Austrian, actually. So is Father Graf. He's Bishop Richter's private secretary, acolyte, and personal bodyguard. He carries a gun whenever the bishop is in public. I'm told he knows how to use it.
I'll keep that in mind. Gabriel showed Donati the photograph he snapped when they were lunching at Piperno in Rome.
That's him. He must have followed me from the Jesuit Curia.
Where might I find him?
You're not to go anywhere near him, or Bishop Richter.
Hypothetically, said Gabriel.
Richter divides his time between his palazzo on the Janiculum Hill and the Order's headquarters in the village of Menzingen in Canton Zug. The Order relocated there in the 1980s. In case you're wondering, the bishop does not travel commercially. The Order of St. Helena is extraordinarily wealthy. He has a private jet at his disposal 24 hours a day.
Who owns it?
A secret benefactor. The man behind the curtain. At least, that's the rumor.
Donati took up the Holy Father's letter.
I only wish my master had told you the name of the book.
Are you familiar with the Collezione? Donati nodded slowly. Would you be able to find it?
That would require gaining access to the manuscript depository. No easy feat. After all, they're called the secret archives for a reason.
Donati looked at the composite sketch of the man who had questioned Stephanie Hoffmann.
You know, Gabriel, you really should consider taking up painting for a living.
Is he a member of the order?
If he is, he isn't a priest.
How can you be sure?
Because the order would never send one of their priests to question someone like Stephanie Hoffmann.
Who would they send?
A professional.
Chapter 21. Rome, Obersalzberg, Bavaria. At 5 o'clock the following morning, Bishop Hans Richter was awakened by a gentle knock at his door. A moment later, a youthful seminarian entered the room, bearing a tray of coffee and a stack of newspapers. The boy placed the tray at the edge of the bed and, receiving no additional instructions, withdrew. Richter sat up and poured a cup of coffee from the ornate silver decanter. After adding sugar and steamed milk, he reached for the newspapers. His spirits sank as he opened La Repubblica. The news from Florence was splashed across the front page. It was obvious the vague statement issued by the Sala Stampa had not played well, especially with Alessandro Ricci, the paper's star investigative reporter and author of a best-selling book about the order. Ricci saw evidence of a conspiracy. Then again, he usually did. Still, there was no denying that Niklas Jonsson's death was a disaster, one with the potential to threaten Richter's ambitions at the coming conclave. He turned to the papers from Germany. They were filled with stories and photographs from the market bombing in Hamburg. The embattled German chancellor had ordered anti-terrorist police to stand guard outside all major rail stations, airports, government buildings, and foreign embassies. Even so, Germany's interior minister had predicted that another attack was likely, probably within the coming days. A new opinion poll showed a sudden surge in support for Axel Brunner and his anti-immigrant National Democrats. Brunner and the Chancellor were now locked in a statistical dead heat. Richter set aside the newspapers and rose from his canopied Biedermeier bed. His apartment was 3,000 square meters, larger than any of the Vatican lodgings occupied by the most senior princes of the church. The rest of the room's luxurious furnishings, the chest of drawers, the armoire, the writing desk, the occasional tables and framed mirrors, were resplendent Biedermeier antiques as well. The paintings were all Italian and Dutch old masters, including works by Titian, Veronese, Rembrandt, Van Eyck, and van der Weyden. They were but a small portion of the order's massive collection, most of which had been acquired for investment purposes. The collection was hidden in a vault beneath the Paradeplatz in downtown Zurich, along with much of Bishop Richter's vast personal fortune. He entered his luxurious bathroom complex. It featured a shower with four heads, a large jacuzzi, a steam room, a sauna, and a built-in audiovisual system. To the accompaniment of Bach's Brandenburg concertos, he bathed and shaved and moved his bowels. Afterward, he dressed not in his usual magenta-trimmed cassock, but in a tailored business suit. Then he pulled on an overcoat and a scarf and headed downstairs. Father Graf was waiting outside in the forecourt next to an elegant Mercedes Maybach limousine. He was a trim, athletic priest of 42 with an angular face, neatly combed blonde hair, and bright blue eyes. Like Bishop Richter, he was of noble Austrian descent. Indeed, the blood that flowed through both their veins was midnight blue. He too was dressed in business rather than clerical attire. He looked up from his mobile phone as Richter approached, and in German bade him a pleasant morning. The rear door of the Maybach was open. Richter slid into the back seat. Father Graf joined him. The car passed through the order's formidable stone and steel security gate and turned into the street. The umbrella pines were silhouettes in the first Siena light of dawn. Richter thought it was almost beautiful. Father Graf was staring at his phone again.
"Anything interesting in the news this morning?" asked Richter. the Polizia di Stato released the identity of the young man who was shot to death in Florence.
Anyone we know?
The priest looked up. Do you know what would have happened if Niklaus had crossed that bridge?
He would have given Pope Accidental's letter to Gabriel alone.
Richter paused.
All the more reason why you should have removed it from the papal study.
It was Albanese's job, not mine.
Richter frowned. He is a cardinal and a member of the order, Marcus. Try to show him at least a modicum of respect.
If it wasn't for the church, he'd be a bricklayer.
Richter examined his reflection in the vanity mirror. The bricklayer's bulletino has brought us some valuable breathing room. But it is only a matter of time before the press finds out where Niklaus was working the night of the Holy Father's death, and that he was a member of the order.
In 6 days it won't matter.
6 days is an eternity, especially for a man like Gabriel Alon.
At the moment, I'm more worried about our old friend, Alessandro Ricci.
As am I. His sources inside the Curia are impeccable. You can be sure our enemies are talking to him.
Perhaps I should have a word with him too.
Not yet, Marcus. But in the meantime, keep an eye on him.
Richter looked out his window and frowned.
My God, this city really is atrocious.
It will be different after we take power, Excellency.
Indeed, thought Bishop Richter. Much different.
The Order's Gulfstream G550 was waiting on the tarmac outside Signature Flight Support at Ciampino Airport. It delivered Bishop Richter and Father Graf to Salzburg, where they boarded an executive helicopter for the short flight across the German border. Andreas Estermann, a former German intelligence officer who served as the Order's Chief of Security and Operations, waited on the helipad of the compound outside Berchtesgaden, his grey blonde hair twisting in the wash of the rotors. He pressed his lips to the ring on Bishop Richter's proffered right hand, then gestured toward a waiting Mercedes sedan.
We should hurry, Excellency. I'm afraid you're the last to arrive.
The car bore them smoothly up the private valley to the chalet, a modern citadel of stone and glass set against the base of the towering mountains. A dozen other vehicles lined the drive, watched over by a small battalion of armed security men. All wore black ski jackets, emblazoned with the logo of the Wolf Group, a Munich-based conglomerate. Estermann escorted Bishop Richter and Father Graf inside and up a flight of stairs. To the left was an anteroom filled with aides and dark-suited security men. Bishop Richter handed Father Graf his overcoat and followed Estermann into the great hall. It was 60 feet by 50, with a single enormous window gazing northward across the Obersalzberg. The walls were hung with Gobelin tapestries and several oil paintings, including what appeared to be Venus and Amor by Bordoni. A bust of Richard Wagner frowned at Richter from its perch atop a plinth. The long case clock, which was crowned by a heraldic Roman-style eagle, read 9 o'clock. Richter, as usual, had arrived precisely on time. He surveyed the others with a jaundiced eye. They were, without exception, an unappetizing lot, scoundrels and grifters, each and every one. But they were also a necessary evil, a means to an end. The laborites and secular social democrats were the cause of Europe's calamitous plight. Only these creatures were prepared to undertake the hard work necessary to undo the damage of 75 years of post-war liberal twaddle. There was, for example, Axel Brunner. His fancy suit and rimless spectacles could not conceal the fact that he was a former skinhead and street brawler whose only claim to fame was a distant blood relationship to the infamous Nazi who had rounded up the Jews of Paris. He was chatting with Cécile Leclerc, his comely counterpart from France, who had inherited her anti-immigrant party from her father, a moron from Marseille. Richter felt a warm blast of coffee-scented breath and, turning, found himself shaking the oily paw of the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Saviano. The next hand he grasped was attached to Peter van der Meer, the platinum-haired, putty-skinned Catholic from Amsterdam, who had promised to rid his country of all Muslims by 2025, an admirable if entirely unattainable goal. Jörg Kaufmann, the camera-ready Austrian Chancellor, greeted Bishop Richter like an old friend, which he was. Richter had presided over Kaufmann's baptism and First Communion, along with his recent wedding to Austria's most famous fashion model
a Union Richter approved with considerable misgivings. Presiding over this menagerie was Jonas Wolf. He wore a heavy roll-neck sweater and flannel-dress trousers. His silver mane of hair was swept back from his face, which was dominated by a bird-of-prey nose. It was a face to be stamped on a coin, thought Richter. Perhaps one day when the Muslim invaders had been cast out and the Roman Catholic Church was once again ascendant, it would be. At 9:05, Wolf took his place at the head of the conference table, which had been placed near the soaring window. Andreas Estermann had been assigned the seat at Wolf's right hand, Bishop Richter at his left. At the German's request, Richter led the assemblage in a recitation of the Lord's Prayer. "And may you grant us the strength and determination to complete our sacred mission," intoned Richter in conclusion. "We do this in your name, through our Lord Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, one God, for ever and ever." "Amen," came the response along the table. Jonas Wolf opened a leather folder. The conference was now in session. The mountain peaks were receding into darkness when Wolf